Hello and welcome to another episode of the How to Scale a Business podcast. My name is Hector Santiesteban and I'm your host for today. And our special guest is Mr. Isaac Stegman. He is the founder and CEO of Kaizen Coaching, amongst a number of things. I mean, we'll probably go through it a little bit, but that's probably the simplest way that we can do it. But you had your hands in a number of businesses and I'm excited to have you on today. So Isaac, thanks for catching us up.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Excited to be here for sure.
When you try and explain to people like what it is that you do, I imagine that's a pretty challenging question because you've got a number of different projects and enterprises and businesses and things going on. So like in your head, what is it that you do?
That's exactly how I explain it. I just have a number of projects and businesses and things that have going on. No, I'm trying to narrow things down currently. The big projects that I have going on, obviously Kaizen Coaching has been something. I started that, you know, over a decade ago. And that's my main thing. And then I'm writing a book called The Courage Project. And about a year ago, I started working with someone named Ivan Meisner, who was the founder of BNI, Business Networking International, to take one of his books, which is called Who's in Your Room, and create a training and coaching certification program around that. So that's kind of a project that's taken more of the forefront lately because we just launched that in December and have had some really fantastic results around that. But the main thing has always been Kaizen, and that is just working with people on performance coaching, mostly in the real estate and mortgage industries, but we've shifted more to executive coaching lately, and specifically executives who are in some sort of transition period.
You know, one of the things that I've kind of noticed from afar, and we've only really got a chance to connect recently, but in seeing your kind of professional journey, if you will, from the outside, what it seems like from a very misinformed, perhaps, perspective and opinion is that, damn, everything that Isaac touches turns to gold. Like,
totally everything,
like everything he does, he crushes it at like a really high level. And it would make sense that you're a performance coach because that's kind of what you're helping people to do. And I'd imagine that, you know, when you're looking behind the curtain, it doesn't always seem as great from the audience seats. What is the common theme that you find that you're able to bring to all the things that you do? Or what's at the core of what you're trying to help with your clients to help raise them from, you know, an average or a mediocre level to all of a sudden, you know, exceptional, if you will?
Well, there's a lot to that question. I have been blessed to have a lot of success in a few different things. And fortunately, the things that I've been terrible at haven't seen the light of day for the most part. So the perception is there that everything I touch turns to gold. Definitely not true. With my clients specifically, my magic, because I've never sold real estate, I never originated a loan for mortgage. However, I came in and coached a real estate agent and his team. So Jeff Latham, who's best friend and a front row dad and all these wonderful things. So I got connected with Jeff and did some coaching for his team. And then he wanted to take a year off and do Tony Robbins Platinum Partner Program. And this is, he was performing at a super high level, did 200 transactions or 202 transactions the year before that, and wanted to do Ironmans. And so he asked me to come in and run his team. Well, I'd never run a real estate team. I'd never done real estate sales, but I had run, you know, a large team for Cutco as a district manager and had some experience through firefighting and military with leadership. So I came in and ran that team and we actually grew the next year. So we had a lot of people who said, well, that sounds really awesome. How do I find someone to come in and help grow my team so I can take a year off, which isn't exactly what Jeff did, but that was, again, the perception that was out there. And so, you know, we started coaching agents, then we started coaching teams, then we started coaching loan officers. And the common theme there wasn't the background. The common theme was there's these universal truths that when we have a good hierarchy of priorities, and when we start saying no to the things that don't matter, and when we infuse values into our organization in a certain way, and when we treat people a certain way and hire and attract and retain the right talent and build the right organization, it doesn't matter what business you're in, the business is going to grow. The business is going to thrive. So we focus mostly on those kinds of principles and less on the kind of day-to-day tactical things in those industries.
You mentioned something earlier about, you know, creating a training about who's in the room. And I'd imagine that there's kind of two, I don't know, two levers that you're pulling, right? The first is the nature part of it, which is the actual skill level and the talent of the people that you're bringing onto the team. But then also you've got to bring them in into some sort of culture that helps those people to thrive. Because what I've seen is that the best organizations often have a leader that's able to bring out the best in their star performers, you know, a la Phil Jackson or, you know, the Bill, whatever, right? The classic coach, John Wooden. And you see the same sort of thing in business leaders as well. How does that happen? What do you think is behind sort of these organizations that get everybody playing at their highest level?
Well, it's not an accident, that's for sure. So it happens purposefully. It happens because you figure the formula out and then you apply the formula. And if you look at a Phil Jackson or you look at a John Wooden, they had players who were very talented that they couldn't coach well. In fact, John Wooden cut a lot of players who were very, very talented who weren't the right fit for the team. And that's an important business concept, is it's not about finding the best talent out there as far as an ability for the role or a skill set. It's about curating the right team and then creating the right culture around them so that they can thrive. And how you do that, here's what a lot of people mess up, is they find somebody they really, really like. They say, oh, I'm going to bring this person into my world, so I'm going to find a spot for them. And so they'll bring them in, they'll put them in a spot, and we're just setting them up for failure because they're maybe the wrong ability, aptitude, attitude. They're in the wrong spot as far as the dynamic of working with someone else on the team. And so, you know, that short-sightedness of seeing someone saying, gosh, I really like that person, I'm going to bring them in and squish them into this box and have them fit no matter what, that can be very harmful long-term. We also have something called sunk cost bias, which means the more we have invested in something, the less we are to see it clearly and get out when we need to. And so we'll fall in love with this person, we'll bring them into our organization, we'll cram them into this role that they're not really a fit for because we didn't have the right fit for that person. And then we will fool ourselves as to why they're not performing well in that role. And even worse, we will teach them that they're actually not talented. They will start to identify as a failure because we put them in a situation where they have to keep failing over and over and over again just because it's the wrong fit. And so what we do instead is you have to look at what is the role that I need to create. So what are the expectations for that role? What are the roles and responsibilities for that specific position? And then what is the ideal makeup of someone who's going to fit that well? So what is the behavioral profile of someone who's going to fit that well? And then you look at other things like, okay, now that I have this kind of sketch of this person and I know what they're going to do and what I'm going to pay them, I'm going to go find the person that fits that. So you may not get the superstar talent, but you get the right fit for the role. And so then that person thrives in that role and overperforms or overachieves in the role. So that's one way to do that.
When you think about that process, is there a wide number of options that you think can make someone successful in bringing on the right person? Or I have, you know, a mentor of mine, a business mentor that, you know, prescribes a really specific process and, you know, has very specific hoops to have these people jump through so that they can figure out if they are the right sort of fit. Where do you stand on the best way to actually determine whether or not that person is going to fit organizationally?
Well, find a process that works for your organization. So some of this is trial and error. And there's the standing on the shoulders of giants thing, but make sure that the giant that you're standing on the shoulders of has done something similar or helped other people in a similar way. And, you know, a lot of people try to square peg round hole. They'll say, oh, this worked for this person over here. I'm going to take and apply it to something completely different and just assume it's going to work, without any iteration or thought into that thing. And again, that's just short-sighted. Then they're wondering why the hire is not performing well. And then there's all the excuses that come up. And honestly, it's a lot of work, right? To create a job description, find the right person, hire them, onboard them, train them, keep them around. And so a lot of people will just settle. They'll settle for the talent they have or the people that they have in the wrong seat on the wrong bus, just because it feels like a lot of work to try to replace that. And we also have to admit that maybe we didn't make the best decision in hiring that person if we're going to make the changes. And so, you know, you see a lot of organizations with mediocre performance as an organization with a bunch of people who should be performing better. They're just in the wrong seat or they were hired for the wrong role.
I would imagine that most of the people who are listening to this show are probably in that spot where they've already got a team. And so I'm wondering, are there red flags? Are there indicators? You know, I was talking with my ops guy the other day about, you know, kind of having circuit breakers in our organization, if you will, to try, you know, just so that we can have a better understanding of kind of what's happening. But I'm curious about, like, for you, what are the red flags, whether it's in the hiring process or maybe once someone onboarded that says, like, hey, either this needs to change, this person needs to go into a different role, or, you know, like, we need to give them some sort of training. Are there indicators that people perhaps may not be aware of?
Yeah, if it looks too good to be true, normally it is. And there's this quote that I love that directly applies to this. Words mean nothing. Actions mean something. Patterns mean everything. And so a candidate, of course, is going to show up and they're going to tell you what they think you want to hear to get what they want, which is a job, right? And they're usually not going to show up better all the other days. Is they usually don't show up, you know, dressed the shabbiest and on their worst behavior to a job interview and then improve going forward. So you kind of take that baseline and go, I think this person is really good. Now I'm going to double check what I think I know. And so having those kind of barriers to entry up front, but then also the hurdles as they go through the process to make sure, do they actually want it? So for example, Chet Holmes wrote a book called The Ultimate Sales Machine. And he would have people come in and he would say, all right, I'm going to advertise for top talent. I only want superstars. You better be the best of the best if you're going to apply for this role. Because anyone who didn't, this is sales roles, anyone who didn't have that level of ego, who didn't think they were the best, wasn't going to thrive in that organization. And then when they came in, he would test them. And so he's like, all right, are they really confident or do they just show up confident on paper? So he would ask them, all right, sit down. You told me that you're the best of the best. Tell me why. Prove it. Sell me. Like, it was that kind of sell me this pen thing to see how do they do under pressure? Because a real rock star is going to rise to that challenge and they're going to have prepared for that situation. And then guess what? Salespeople sometimes get objections, right? So he would start throwing them objections in the interview. He would say something like, you know, based on what I've heard so far, I really am not seeing why you think you're top talent. And if they crumble at that, they're never going to thrive in a sales role. Because that first little objection is going to throw them off. And so he would throw that out and hopefully they would say something like, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. And then they would come back with their counter to that, right? So they would sell themselves. If they want a sales role, they need to be able to sell at least themselves. If they can't sell themselves, they can't sell what I'm going to hire them to sell.
Yeah, this is really good stuff that I think is relevant to business owners really at any stage. What we've talked a lot about though so far is kind of the hiring and maybe a little bit about the onboarding process. But what I'd guess is that the organizations who do it at the highest level is that they're able to carry it through throughout the entire experience that someone has on their team. And that's how it kind of creates that culture. So when we get back from break, Isaac, I want to ask you about how someone can integrate these sorts of things into their everyday, right? To their team that's showing up to regular meetings, that the people that they already have on board, you know, how might they get the best out of them? So we're going to get into that right after this quick break. Hey, y'all, today's episode is brought to you by Amplify Media, and we are a podcast and content production company. Well, we like to think of ourselves as platform builders because chances are, if you're listening to this, you have a product, a passion, a mission, a message, something that you're trying to get out to the world, but you may not have the time, the team, or the tech skills to do it. If that's the case, we can help. Go to amplifymedia.com. That's AMPLAFY media.com. You can also check the show notes for info. And with that, let's get back to Isaac. So Isaac, we both started my very first job in the sales organization that you mentioned earlier. And what was interesting is that going to some of those organizations, it seemed like a lot of the focus, at least, you know, a lot of the work was done in the front end, in the recruiting, the onboarding, the initial training. But what I saw that the profits and the long-term growth or the next level of scale, which is really what it was about retention and developing people and keeping people around and creating this culture that kind of, I don't want to say replaced you, but in essence, did that sort of thing on its own. So what should business owners, how might they approach that thing? Because just after I say that sounds like a pretty daunting task, given remote work and distributed workforce and the number of employees and all that sort of stuff. So how might business owners kind of approach that whole thing?
You know, the people that I saw at that organization and since that have done that really well, they were all themselves. They embraced who they really were. And you had people on very different ends of the spectrum who were super outgoing and were just all of that super reserved and professional. And they both built teams around who they were. So I think it's important for people to first, like, know who you are. Just do the work to discover, who am I? What are my strengths? What do I bring to the table when I'm the best version of myself? Know what the company is, like, who is the company? What is our brand identity as a company? And then know who your ideal team member is. So values are a great way to look at this. And for me, I have a hard time working with someone who's not a self-starter. Like, if they're not self-motivated and I have to just tell them all the time, do this now, or they're just sitting around doing nothing, that would never fly for me. So they have to be self-motivated. They have to be kind. You know, they have to be a good human being. I have to like working with them. There's these certain, you know, proactive, resourceful, they have to be able to figure stuff out. I don't want to be the person that solves all the other people's problems, because that breaks down at scale. It's fine when you have one or two people on your team who come to you with problems. When you have one or 200 people on your team, you can't handle all of their problems. And so, again, finding that right fit and saying the right person who's going to thrive in this organization for what that is and with who I am looks mostly like this. And then create a container for them to be able to thrive as themselves. So don't try to have them be someone they're not being either. Celebrate their differences, celebrate what they bring to the table, and continue to help them grow. So you have to help challenge people. So put some resistance in their way and then help push them through it. You know, that's talent universally. They want to be challenged. They don't want things to be too easy, and they want to feel like they're continuing to grow. They don't want to get stagnant. And so if there's opportunity continually put in front of them, and then you help them grow in a way that allows them to tackle that opportunity, grow as a human and get to the next level, that's when people don't leave. They just stick around and create more and more culture in the organization and then bring other people up under them.
As you're talking about this, I'm seeing like tough conversations being a really big part of this, because I would imagine that a lot of people think, oh, this is just about making things sound hunky-dory and kumbaya, and we all sit around and, you know, play bongos together. And perhaps that may play a role in it. But I'd also imagine that, at least in my sense, the reasons that it hasn't happened in the way that you've laid out is because of my unwillingness to have those tough conversations when things were out of alignment with that culture.
Yeah, the conversations you're avoiding are just, they're the conflicts that are coming, right? So the conversations you're avoiding are the conflicts that are coming. And the longer we avoid the conversation, usually the bigger the conflict is going to be, and the more chance that it's going to be a I go my way, you go your way type conversation. And they don't have to be confrontational, especially if you are upfront about, here's how we handle conflict in our organization. So have a policy and just let everyone know, this is how we deal with conflict. Is it's not me versus you. It's us trying to tackle this problem. So you and I are on the same side of the table. In fact, when I would have difficult conversations with people, I wouldn't sit across from them. I would sit down next to them. I would sit kitty corner at a desk with them. And I would almost look, you know, like we're both looking in the same direction when I'm talking about the problem, right? The problem is not them. I'm not judging them. So stay out of judgment and stay curious, because we don't know everyone's situation. We assume we do. We assume they're just like us until we figure out we don't like being judged or assumed about either. And if you start with the values as the bedrock of your organization and of the culture that you create, it's not a you did something wrong, I don't like you. It's a this doesn't match our values, how do we fix it? And so if you say, these are our company core values, this is what we're founded on, you say that right in the beginning so that people that do not resonate with that can self-opt out and say, that doesn't fit me and my style. And the people who do resonate with it, if you're hiring to your values, these are not going to be blowout conversations where they're walking away, you're walking away. This is typically, you're right, I also value that thing and I can see how that wasn't honored here. yes, I do want to help resolve that or fix it. And so it's us sitting down together and saying, all right, so this didn't look like that value. Now, how can we more easily, how can we better address that particular situation? I'm trying to be pretty general. There was a situation that popped in my mind and I'd rather not talk about it. So how can we address that together to honor the value? So it's, I'm on your side and we're both trying to get better for the sake of the organization and what it stands for. It's not me versus you anymore.
Yeah, this is really, really cool. And I think a great mindset shift for a lot of business owners. Do you have any other favorite tools in your toolbox? You know, I would imagine that there are things that you find yourself suggesting often, whether it's a system, a strategy, a tactic, a book, you know, are there things that you find are helpful? You know, once you've identified what sort of the challenge is, are there things that you're prescribing more than others?
Depends on the challenge. So I talk to a lot of people who are completely overwhelmed. And generally, overwhelm comes from a lack of priority. They think it's time management. They think, oh, I'm not managing my time well, but I have the same amount of time you do, and so does everybody else. It's what we do with the time. And so what that comes down to is that's a priority problem, not a time problem. And so generally what I'll walk people through is an understanding that you can't do it all as much as you would like to think you can, or tell other people that you can or believe you can. You can't do it all. And so since you can't do it all, you have to look at what should I do that's the highest and best. And one thing a lot of people don't look at is they just pick a bunch of good things to do, but they don't look for alignment. They don't look for how do these things interact with each other. And so what you end up with is if you have something that's really good here and then something that's not in alignment with that, you end up with this margin here that's conflict, anxiety, overwhelm, frustration. And that's where people live because they have a whole bunch of things that don't sync up. There's not this alignment and congruency to their life and their business. And so things are always constantly pulling at each other. And that's why we feel the way that we do when we're feeling really stressed or overwhelmed. And so looking at not only are my priorities what I want them to be, but are they aligned with each other and lining up in the same direction? Are they aligned with my values? Are they aligned with the people in my life? So that's where like good things can cause bad problems, is you pick something that independently is really good. It looks really good. But when you put it in the mix, it becomes toxic, right? So when you're looking at that, I call it the 100% rule. You only get 100% of your time, money, energy, attention, anything like that. And you can't squeeze anything else in without inadvertently squeezing something else out. So you can't just fit it in. There's no extra minutes that you get that nobody else on the planet gets where you're like, oh yeah, I'll squeeze it in, you know, somewhere. Something gets displaced by that. And if we're not purposeful about what we're putting in our lives and what we're taking out, the things that get squeezed out are generally the things that over the long term create a lot of problems for us. There are, you know, romantic relationships, relationships with our kids, that's our physical health or our nutrition or, you know, time for ourselves or our faith. Like it's those things that get squeezed out because they're not at the top of the heap yelling for attention, you know, like some of the other things. And we have this fallacy that we can do it all, and we simply can't. So the trick that helped me was to flip my yeses and nos. So I had a hard time for many, many years saying no, because I wanted people to like me and I wanted to be able to say yes, because I just feels good, right? What I realized finally was that when I said yes to something that wasn't a priority, what it meant was I was saying no to all of the other things on my priority list that should have taken that place. So every time I said yes, when it was out of alignment, I was actually saying a bunch of no's, which I don't like saying. And I flipped it back and said, all right, every time I say no to something that's not a priority, I now get to say yes to something else that is a priority better. I get to give more time, more energy, more attention, more money to something that really does matter to me. And the last evolution of that was a realization that I'm stealing from really the things and people that matter most to me when I give time and attention and energy to things that don't matter. So the first thing that comes to mind when I'm thinking about that is, this was 8-10 years ago. I was super busy, and I thought it was because I was doing really well and very popular with all the things I was going to, all the big national networking things and meeting, you know, very important people. And at the same time, I had three kids at home and a wife who weren't getting a lot of my attention and really wanted it still at that point. And I remember one day driving home, and I had a client who I probably should have said no to in the first place, should not have brought that client on because we were not a values match. But I, you know, the money, I was doing it for the money so that was for my family. Thing a lot of people say, you know, like, I'm doing this for my family, except if you ask them, they don't want that. So I'm driving home and this client calls and they're really upset, just like a lot of times they were upset. Lots of drama around this thing, which was good for me because that means consistent business because they'll want to call me. But it's also bad because it steals so much of my energy, my soul. So I get home and I'm walking up to the door and I'm like, oh, I got to get off the phone with this client. I'm probably an hour late getting home already and dinner's cold or already, you know, off the table. My kids were expecting to see me. I'm like, I just got to wrap this up, but they are just going and going. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to go in the house, go downstairs. We lived in a split level at the time. So downstairs, the whole downstairs was like my office. And so I'm like, I'm going to go downstairs, shut the door, finish this conversation with the client, turn my phone off and like go back up and try to spend some time with my family. So I walk through the door and I see my son over here on the stairs and he jumps up and I'm like, I'll be with you when I get a chance, bud. And I give him the finger, right? And it's the first finger. It's the hold on a minute finger. It's not the middle finger, but that's in my mind, the worst finger. And I go downstairs and I finish my call and it takes way longer than it should have, probably another 45 minutes because they were just really on a roll and had all these problems I needed to solve or they were going to quit. I finally make it back upstairs. They're getting ready for bed, you know, and I just missed my window of time with my family. Well, let's flip the scene here. My kids were homeschooled. So they would do projects during the day. They would make like these Lego creations or something with cardboard or draw something really cool or paint something. And especially my youngest son was always excited to show dad, you know, and he was probably 5 or 6 at the time. And so he doesn't remember this, I'm sure, but it probably wasn't the only time I did this. It's just the time that immediately comes to mind and makes me regret all of the other times. And so he had finished a project and was sitting on the stairs waiting for dad. And I don't know how long he was waiting for me, but I was supposed to be home maybe an hour before I was. So I imagine it was quite a while with, you know, his project for the day. And he hears dad's car pull up. And so he gets excited and he hears dad walk up to the door and open the door and he jumps up and he's going to show me, you know, so that I'm proud of him and tell him, hey, great job, bud. And instead of saying great job, I just completely shut him down. I give him the finger, which means you're not important right now. Know your place. Somebody else more important is getting my time and attention right now. You're going to have to wait. And like I said, at the time, it didn't register from the other side what I was doing. But looking back, like that's my biggest regret, is the things that I said to my kids without saying anything. The moments that I made other things a priority that weren't really important in life. The messages I communicated that they're not important or special, or if somebody's paying me money, that matters more, because I would do anything right now to go back. You know, my kids are teenagers now. They're all, my oldest son's graduating in like a month. And you don't get back that time. When you misplace your priorities and don't honor the things that matter most, you can try to fix it later. You can try to rectify the situation, change, make it better. And I have tried, but you can't go take it back. And so when we talk about priorities and looking at those things, we're so casual and cavalier about giving our time and our energy and our attention to things that don't matter. We're giving our attention and our time and our energy to TikTok or scrolling through Instagram or that client who we don't even really like. And every time we do that, and I'm bringing it back home here, every time we do that, we are stealing time, attention, energy from the people and the things that matter most. And there's this disconnect that happens where we have our stated priorities and our demonstrated priorities. We would like to think that, oh, you know, to use Keller Williams, God, family, business, like this is my hierarchy of priorities. But very few times have I talked with people and asked them to be honest about this, where their stated priorities of like, this is what I say is important to me, number one, two, three, four, five. And then if I were honest about my life over the last 30 days and where I gave my time and my attention, was there anything that took the place of one of those as a priority in my life that I wish I could go back and replace with the time with my kids or with my business or with my health or something that matters most? We're so casual about giving away those things, and we're only stealing from ourselves and the people that we love.
Yeah. So important stuff. This was a very needed conversation. And Isaac, I'm grateful that you were willing to share that story, because it hit me, and I know I've given the wrong finger to my kids a number of times. And so it's just a really good reminder. If people want to get more connected with you, Isaac, go deeper in your world, where's the best place to catch up and follow up with you?
Yeah. KaizenCoaching.com, KAIZEN coaching.com. There's a box on there where you can submit a request for a call. That's the best way. Or just follow me, Isaac Stegman, ISAAC Stegman, on just about any platform. There's like three of us in the world, so I'm not too hard to find, but those are the best places to find me.
I love it. And there's a few other Hector Santia Stebans for some strange reason. Yeah. There's more of us. The other one's a doctor, and he kills me on Google because he comes up first because he's a doctor. And so I'm working on it. Guys, ladies, listeners, thank you for hanging out with us. We appreciate you being here. We would be forever grateful for a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know someone who needs to hear this, someone who's in the midst of scaling their business, hit that share button and let's grow the community together. Go get connected with Isaac. We'll drop all of the links down in the show notes. But appreciate you hanging out. We'll see you on the next one. Later, y'all.